One of the joys of having so much free time in between the services, besides wearing the kids out, hopefully before we do, which isn't always guaranteed, is it? Is to be able to talk of the messages and interact with each other on the topics. And boy, this is we've had two marvelous topics to which to do, haven't we? Where it's been my experience just that the Lord is speaking through His servants, and we're just so excited for that and thankful to God for that. And so, Brother Mark, if you would come on up, and we'll hope to be excited to speak of this third.
Well, it's good to see you again this evening. I get so uptight about these things. I've already been told I'm not coming back. Most places, it's three strikes and you're out. Here, they just give you two and you're out of the rotation. No, what a blessing just to get invited back somewhere. I get invited to a lot of places. I don't get invited back very often, so that's quite a privilege and a wonderful time to be with you folks. It's so good to see you, and just to renew acquaintances, folks, in some cases, I'm looking at Bill and Linda over here. I hadn't seen them in 25 years or more, and to see you going on with the Lord, that's the greatest blessing of all, to meet new folks. And I see we have some new folks with us tonight, and I feel sorry for you in a way, because we've covered a lot of ground last evening, and we don't have time. I've got to cover about 40 chapters tonight. We're going to take a look at the rest of the book of Job. We looked at those first two chapters last evening, and so we just don't have time to go back and rehash. I'll try to bring you up to speed. Let's get busy. Job, the fourth chapter. I'll just start us there. Job, the fourth chapter, we'll read the first nine verses. Again, I'm making an assumption that you are already fairly familiar with the story of Job. You know a little bit about what's going on. Job 4, verse 1. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "If we essay to commune..." That means if we venture to talk with you, "wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upheld him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, the uprightness of thy ways? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his nostrils they are consumed." Well, we have seen in these first two chapters the great trial that has befallen Job. We have seen the conflict in the heavens between God and Satan, God sicking Satan on Job, God moving and allowing Satan to have a degree of power against Job. First, Satan takes away all that Job owns, all he possesses, takes away his children, and yet Job remains faithful. Second round, recall, Satan is allowed to touch his flesh but cannot take his life. And we see Satan is very efficient when he is given that kind of power and that kind of permission. Job is smitten with a horrible disease, boils from the sole of his feet to the top of his head. I can't imagine such misery, sitting in the ashes, scraping himself with broken pieces of pottery. And then notice at the end of this, we saw his three friends arrive. Eliphaz, the Temanite. Bildad, the shortest man in the Bible, the Shuhite. And so far, the Naamathite, his three friends come to comfort him. And that is where we will pick up tonight. I tried to lay it gently on you last night that I do not feel after studying this book that this is really about suffering. And that's how we approach the book generally. We want to get answers to why we suffer. And what we have seen in the very beginning of this book is that God is being moved against Job for no good reason, without cause. The Hebrew word kinam, it's freely. That is, for no reason. Now, that doesn't mean there's absolutely no reason. There is a reason. There is this conflict that's going on in the heaven between God and Satan. But there is no reason to be found in Job why these things are coming upon him. This is not punishment. That is what everybody's assuming. And what we begin to see is this book has a lot to say about what we call legalism. And again, I wish I had a better word, because that sounds like when you preach against legalism, you're preaching against the law, and that's not what I intend. I'm not talking about licentiousness, but I'm talking about misusing the law, what Israel did with the law, making it a mechanism for self-justification in the sight of God, misusing it, thinking that because they've obeyed the law, God owes them something. That's the way legalism works, quid pro quo. In the legal field, something for something, tit for tat, the stick and the carrot. You know how that works. In the Eastern religions, they call it karma. You know, your bad deeds eventually catch up to you, your good deeds eventually are rewarded. We'll see that the principle of legalism is what pervades this world, and it is what you and I must be not saved by, but saved from. We're all legalists. We were born legalists. That's our natural, it's the state religion of Satan's kingdom. And we were all baptized, sprinkled as babies, into that state religion of Satan. It's how we think. You take the youngest kid here, and they're sitting at the table, and he got more ice cream than I got. It's not fair. Now, is that just my kids, or is that the way you're... It's not fair. Where'd that come from? They're born legalists, you see. And it is that from which we must be delivered. And we're seeing here that God is operating by a completely different principle with his servant Job. And Job responds so admirably in the beginning. But as this thing wears on, we see there is a problem that he is wrestling with. And that's our problem. We are living supposedly by a different rule of thumb, but we're living in a world of legalists. It is the spiritual battle that you and I must fight and face. I was reading Frederick Godet is one of my favorite commentators. He was back in the 1800s in Switzerland. And commenting on the passage over in 1 Thessalonians where Paul is talking about he would have come to them once and twice, but Satan withstood him. You are familiar with that passage? I'm not going to take the time to look it up, but he just throws this out. And he says, most of the time when Paul was talking about Satan, he was talking about the legalists, the Judaizers. And I got to thinking, well, you know, that's exactly right. You know, we get the idea Satan was standing there in a red suit with a pitchfork and wouldn't let Paul by. But clearly what Paul is referring to is these men that were keeping him from going where he's going to go. Well, why did he call them Satan? Because you see, that's what they're trying to do, introduce legalism into the gospel. That's exactly how Satan works. And so, aside, we are called to live by a different principle, and we're going to talk more about that tomorrow evening as we try to apply these things to where we are in our walk. But we've got to live in a world of legalism. And that's the spiritual battle that we fight. That's what we're constantly battling against, is things just don't seem to be working out like we think they ought to. It's just not fair. And that's the struggle that Job is going to have. We see Satan tip his hand in chapter 2, verse 4, where he says, skin for skin, something for something. We see this principle in Job's wife, curse God and die. In other words, do something really bad, curse God, and he will most certainly put you to death. That's the way her mind works. But we especially see it in these three friends who have come to comfort him. Eliphaz apparently is the eldest of these three friends, because he's the one who speaks first and he's the one who speaks longest. Now they're going to take three turns. Everybody but Zophar has, he just has two turns. And the idea is Job speaks, then one of these guys speaks, then Job speaks, one of these guys speaks. And I can sum up the 30 chapters. Job, you did something bad. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. That's it. It's 30 chapters of back and forth. These accusations that you must have done something terrible, because bad things like these don't happen to good people. Did you catch our text? Look there in Job chapter 4 in verse 7. What is it that Eliphaz says? Remember, I pray thee. And by the way, notice the insinuation in the previous verses that you used to be the one who comforted people. You used to be the one who gave counsel and advice when others were in your situation. And it's almost as if he's throwing Job's counsel back at him. Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or were the righteous ever cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. In other words, Job, God just doesn't do this kind of thing to good people. You must have done something bad. And it must be something really bad. If the punishment fits the crime, then your crime must be enormous, because look at what has befallen you. Eliphaz is going to take three passes at him, and by the time he gets to the end, it's like the old farmers back home. You sort of hem-haw around for an hour or so before you come out and really say what you mean. Look in chapter 22. In Eliphaz's last speech, you know, notice here he just says, the innocent don't suffer. You must have done something wrong. But here in chapter 22, in verse 5, his third pass, he says this to Job. Job 22, verse 5. Are not thy wickedness great, and thine iniquities infinite? For thou hast taken a pledge from thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing. Thou hast not given water to the weary to drink. Thou hast withheld bread from the hungry. But as for the mighty man, he had the earth, and the honorable man dwelt in. In other words, you got it all. You had it all, but you wouldn't help these folks. Verse 9, you sent widows away empty. The arms of the fatherless have been broke. You broke orphans' arms. You've done this cruel thing. Therefore, verse 10, snares are round about thee, sudden fear troubleth thee, darkness that thou canst not see, and abundance of waters cannot cover thee. Notice the charges. Now, where's his witnesses? Where's the proof that Job did this? Notice that it is all deduction. These things don't happen to good people. So you obviously have done something horrible. Plus, if the punishment fits the crime, it's not just some small thing. You have done one of the worst things you can do. And what he has listed here, making people sleep naked at night because you won't let them have their cloak, turned away widows, broken the arms of orphans. In other words, it must be something on that level. But it is all conjecture. He has no proof. He has no witnesses. His proof is the punishment that he sees falling upon Job. The other guys are just like him. Job chapter 8, if you'll turn there, we see Bildad speak. Remember, Job lost his children in the wind, the storm that blew the house down on them. Job 8 verse 3, Bildad says, does God pervert justice, judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? Does God ever do anything wrong, make mistakes? And by the way, notice they say a lot of good things. It's their point. It's their conclusions that are the problem. If thy children have sinned against them, and he has cast them away for their transgressions. Notice the insinuation that your children died. They must have been bad kids. They must have done something to deserve this. If thy children have sinned against him, he cast them away for their transgressions. If thou wouldest seek unto God betimes or early, and make thy supplication to the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. To their credit, they are constantly driving Job to confess his sin, and they are promising him that God will bless him if he does. And yet, notice the insinuation. You've done something. Your kids must be wicked. God just doesn't do this to the innocent. And then Zophar in chapter 11, verse 4. Job 11, verse 4, "For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacts of thee less than thine iniquity deserves." In other words, you're claiming innocence, Job, but if God could, if he would speak, he would tell us the real story here. He would give us the scoop. You're just hiding. You're covering up. And if we just knew the truth, then we would understand why all of this has come upon you. It is the Maria von Trapp doctrine. Because it's what Julie Andrews sang as she was looking in the eyes of her beloved. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. So, somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. That's legalism. Good things happen because we have done, we're being rewarded for good things. And the opposite side, of course, is here in Job's case, because this has befallen you, then somewhere in your youth or childhood, you must have done something horrible to have something like this come upon you. But just notice their counsel, if you'll go to Job chapter 5 a moment, back to Eliphaz. Job chapter 5 in verse 17. Our brother Jason was talking about TBN, the health and wealth gospel. My friend, that can't even compare to what you find right here. What they promised Job, if he'll just come clean, if he'll just confess his sins, if he'll just get right with God, look what they promise him. In Job chapter 5, verse 17, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore despise not thou not the chastening of the Almighty." By the way, that's quoted in the book of Hebrews chapter 12. These guys say some good things. They're just misapplying it. "For he maketh sore and bindeth up. He woundeth and his hands make whole." In other words, the same God who has wounded you can heal you if you'll just turn to him, if you'll just confess your sins. "He shall deliver thee in 6 troubles, yea, in 7 there shall no evil touch thee. In famine he shall redeem thee from death, in war from the power of the sword. Thou shalt be hidden from the scourge of the tongue, neither shalt thou be afraid of destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine thou shalt laugh, neither shalt thou be afraid of the beast of the earth. Thou shalt be in league with the stones of the field." If you're a farmer, you understand that. "The stones of your field will make peace with you. And the beast of the field shall be at peace with thee. And thou shalt know that thy tabernacle shall be in peace. Thou shalt visit thy habitation and shalt not sin. Thou shalt know also that thy seed shall be great and thine offspring as the grass of the earth. Thou shalt come to thy grave in a full age, like as a shock of corn cometh in its season. Lo, this we have searched it. So it is. Hear it and know that it is for thy good." In other words, every possible good thing you can imagine. If you'll just come clean, just confess your sin, get right with God, all of these blessings shall come upon you. You see the legalism in the mindset here. Well, Job, to say the least, is not comforted by these characters. In chapter 12, verse 2, if you like good comebacks, you know, there are certain people that just have a knack putting people down. Job is one of those kinds of guys here. In Job chapter 12, verse 2, I like what he says here. He says, "No doubt, but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you." In other words, the whole sum of wisdom is contained in you guys, and when you guys die, the world will lose its wisdom, because you've got it all. I like that. Or look over in chapter 13, verse 4. He says of these friends, "But ye are forgers of lies, ye are all physicians of no value." I've been to those kind of doctors, physicians of no value, absolutely useless. You've come to comfort me, and all you've done is just increase my discomfort. Chapter 16, verse 2. Chapter 16, verse 2, I have heard many such things, miserable comforters are ye all. In other words, it's absolutely worthless what you're saying to me. And he accuses them of a lot of things. And number one, and this is quite fascinating, of accepting God's person. Now that's a strange thing, but look at it here in chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 7. He says, will ye speak wickedly for God? In other words, you're just on God's side because he's big and bad, you know? You don't want to contradict him. Are you going to take God's, speak wickedly for God and talk deceitfully for him? Will ye accept his person? Will ye contend for God? What does it mean to be acceptor of persons? You know, we use that. God is no respecter of persons. Well, it's like Lady Justice down at the courthouse. You know, has the scales in her hands. That's equity, the idea of what's just and fair. And then a blindfold around her eyes. And what is that indicating? That she doesn't care who it is that stands before, whether it's a white man or black man, rich man, poor man, doesn't care. She does not respect the person. And so what Job is accusing his friends of doing is simply taking God's side because he's God. It's an interesting charge. In chapter 9... back up just a little bit here. Chapter 9, verse 7. And I hate that we have to skip around like this, but to get through, we're going to have to. Chapter 9, verse 17. Job says, for he breaks me, speaking of God, with a tempest. He multiplieth my wounds, kinam, without cause. He's doing this for no good reason. Go a little further. He will not suffer me to take my breath, but fills me with bitterness. And if I speak of strength, lo, he is strong. And if of judgment, who shall set me a time to plead? If I justify myself, my own mouth shall condemn me. If I say I'm perfect, he shall prove me perverse. Though I were perfect, yet would I not know my soul. I would despise my life. The idea is, it really doesn't matter. God is so great. God is so big. God is so powerful and strong that, well, you just can't reason with. You're not going to win this battle. Look at verse 23, this same chapter. If the scourge slay suddenly, he will laugh at the trial of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked, and he covers the faces of his judges. In other words, there's all of this bad, the same stuff that Solomon complains about in the book of Ecclesiastes, the injustices of the earth. That this is what's going on. And God is doing this. And look at this last phrase of verse 24. If it's not God, where and who is he? Then tell me who is doing it. If God's not in charge of this thing, if this is not God's will, then please tell me who is in charge. And then chapter 23. Chapter 23, verse 3. Let's start in verse 2. Chapter 23, verse 2. Job says, even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him. I would fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say unto me. Will he plead against me with his great power? No, but he would put strength in me. There the righteous might dispute with him, and so I would be delivered forever from my judge. Oh, if I could, you know, if I could just get up my day in court, if I could just find him, if I could just go before his presence, I would plead my case like an attorney pleads a case in a court of law. I will set my arguments in order. I will present my case, and God would surely see the injustice that's being done to me, and surely he would correct it. But there's a problem. Verse 8, behold, I go forward, but he's not there. Backward, I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hides himself on the right hand that I cannot see him. But he knows the way that I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. See, the problem is God's never in his office. I want to show up and I want to, you know, I want to present my case, but he's never in. I can't find him. I look for him over here. He's not there. I go forward. I go backward. Go left. I go right. Do you see the perplexity that Job finds himself in? And then chapter 27, verse 6. Oh, I'm condensing this too much, I'm sure. Look at verse 4, chapter 27, verse 4. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you. He's talking to his friends. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast, and I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. What Job is saying, what he's arguing, is that these fellows are saying, you've done something terrible, you've done something horrible. And Job is saying, no, I haven't. Now, he's not claiming sinless perfection here. You'll find places where he will say that I have not covered up my sin. Like Adam put a covering on to hide his sin before God, he will say, I've not covered my sin. The idea is that Job is keeping what we would say are short accounts with God. That there is no consciousness of any sin that he's committed that he has not come clean and confessed to God. These guys are saying, Job, you're hiding something. You're covering up. And Job is simply arguing back, fellas, I've not done anything. What you're thinking is comparable to the judgment I'm receiving. I have no consciousness of having committed a sin on this level that would receive this judgment. And so, I'm not going to go before God, just play a game, pretend to be a sinner, pretend to have committed some great sin, and ask God to forgive me. That would be to go against my integrity. You see what he's saying? We just want you to walk the aisle and say you're a sinner, and pray a prayer, and bingo, everything will be right. And Job says, no, I'm not going to do it. I have no consciousness of committing a crime on the level of what you guys are accusing me of, and I will never say I have if I haven't. And for that, he ought to be commended. But at the same time, in verse 6 here in chapter 27, he's saying, my righteousness I hold fast. And you have to understand that along with our righteousness comes the idea of our right. That my righteousness gives me the right to something. And Job is complaining that I am not being treated fairly. I'm not being treated as I deserve to be treated. And I'm holding fast to my righteousness. It's very much akin to the parable of the prodigal son. When the elder brother, after the son has come back, begins to complain, you never threw a party like that for me. And this your son comes back who wasted your substance with the prostitutes down there in that far off country, you did this for him. In other words, that is the constant complaint of the legalists. I am not getting treated like I deserve, and he's getting treated better than he deserves. That's what happens at the table with your children. He's getting what he didn't deserve. I'm not getting my fair share. That's what Job is wrestling with through this whole thing. And then we come to the final speech of Job in chapters 29 and 30, or actually, where Job's getting around to what hurts the most. I know, I've just got to condense this for the sake of time. He says in chapter 29, there was a time when I walked into town. You know the old saying, when E.F. Hutton talks? Everybody listens, y'all remember those? I'm dating myself here, all you young folks. You don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But some of you older folks remember that commercial. Well, that's what Job says. Man, when I walked into town, everybody shut up. Because you see, everybody wanted to listen to me. Everybody stood up when I came to town. I was somebody. I was the one that when you had a problem, he's the one you want to talk to. You want his advice. He's the one who can settle the conflicts. He's going to right the wrongs. I was really something. And then in chapter 30, look at verse 1. But now, that was then, now they that are younger than I hold me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. I wouldn't have put their daddies over my dogs, let alone with my sheep. I was somebody. And that's all gone. Do you understand that the greatest trial that we face in life is what this does to our pride? Because you know what everybody else is thinking. He knows what these three friends are thinking. And he goes on to say, well, you know, once I was really something, but look in chapter 30, verse 9, or verse 8. They were the children of fools, yea, children of base men. They were viler than the earth. And now I am their song, yea, I am their byword. These that I wouldn't have put over my dogs are now mocking me. They're singing songs about me. They're making fun of me. That's what I have been reduced to. And so finally we come to his conclusion in chapter 31 that, well, it's like this. You know the expression, if I've ever did this, then let lightning strike me? Well, that's how it ends. Job says, if I've ever chased another woman, then let somebody else have my wife. If I've ever not extended my arm to the poor and the needy, then let somebody rip my arm out of its socket. If I've ever worshipped the sun or the moon and the stars, if I've ever done a base act like that, then let my crops fail and thorns and thistles grow. That's how he ends his argument. I have not done anything to deserve this. And so for 30 chapters almost, we've gone back and forth, back and forth. No progress has been made. He's being accused of what he has not done. But yet from Job's point of view, he is being sorely mistreated. He's getting a bill when he ought to have a credit to his account. And he doesn't understand. Well, there's been a fourth fella that we've not really been introduced to till now. In chapter 32, we see a young guy, his name is Elihu, who has been sitting by patiently about to burst. But he has waited his turn in true good old Oriental style. Let the old guys go first. He has sat there and listening, and all the time, as we see in chapter 32, he is angry with Job because he's righteous in his own eyes. In verse 2, he's angry at these three friends because and at Job because he justified himself rather than God, but also against the three friends. Is his wrath kindled because they found no answer and yet had condemned Job? Let that sink in. They have no evidence, they have no witnesses, but they have condemned Job. Now, if you read the commentators, sort of the history of how people have looked at Elihu, you'll find that he is not treated very well. Most commentators assume that this is just a young guy full of himself, a blowhard who wants his turn, and he adds really nothing to the argument at all. My opinion is exactly the opposite. I think he's the man of the hour. I think, humanly speaking, he's the one who hits the nail right on the head. He is the hero of the story, humanly speaking, in my view. I'll tell you why in just a minute. I like his tact, the way he approaches this. Look in chapter 33, verse 8 and 9. Chapter 33, verse 8. Elihu says to Job, surely thou hast spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the words of the voice of thy words, saying, I am clean without transgression. I am innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he, God, finds occasions against me. He counts me for his enemies. He puts my feet in the stocks. He marks all my paths. Behold, in this thou art not just. I will answer thee that God is greater than man. I want you to notice, first of all, that Job's three friends are accusing him on the basis of what they thought he has done. Works they think he has committed. Elihu says, I'm not going to accuse you of what I think you've done. I'm going to accuse you of what I heard you say. I'm the witness. It's not your works, Job, that is the problem. It's your words. These guys are saying you're suffering because you sinned. Elihu is going to say you're sinning because you're suffering. And I heard you say these things. You have accused God. His basic argument, and you see it right here, God is greater than you. I'm going to have you go to another place in chapter 35, a little later in Elihu's speech. In chapter 35, verse 2, Elihu says to Job, "Thinkest thou this to be right, that thou sayest, my righteousness is more than God's? For thou hast said, what advantage will it be unto thee? And what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin? What good has it done me that I've lived a righteous and holy life? What has that gotten me? I'm sitting here in the ashes scraping myself." Okay? "I will answer thee and thy companions with thee. Look unto the heavens and see and behold the clouds which are higher than thou." You remember he just said God is greater than you. And it's like he's saying to Job, "Job, you need to look up. You're looking on a horizontal level. Look up to this one who is up there in the heavens." Verse 6, "If thou sinnest, what doest thou against him? Or if thy transgression be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? If thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receives he of thy hand? Thy wickedness may hurt a man as you are, and thy righteousness may profit the son of man." Do you see what Elihu is saying? Legalism works by the idea that I do good and I've helped you, and therefore you owe me. Sort of like I go out and chop cotton for you all day, and at the end of the day, you owe me because I benefited you. When you sin, you've hurt somebody. You've taken something that belongs to them and you owe it back. That's the way legalism functions. But Elihu is saying to Job, "Job, you can throw rocks at God all day long and he'll never say, ouch." Your sin is not sin because it hurts God, because it robs God. You can sin all day long and he will not be diminished in the least. Your righteousness does not advantage God. It doesn't help you. "I'm going to give God a hand. He doesn't need your hand. I'm going to give him a cow. He owns the cows on 1,000 hills. He really doesn't need your cow." Do you understand the principle? Legalism assumes that my good things help and my bad things hurt. And Elihu is saying, "Job, you need to look up. You need to understand that we're not talking about a fellow man on the horizontal plane. That's where legalism comes in. We're talking about your God." Wish I could remember that. This is not quid pro quo. You neither help him when you obey, nor do you hurt him when you sin. And then the question is, Job, do you really seek the stuff of God or the God of the stuff? And that's a pointed question, one that I have to wrestle with. Am I after the blessing of God or the God of the blessing? Read on down here in verse 10 or verse 9. Job 35, verse 9. "By reason of the multitude of oppressions, they make the oppressed to cry. They cry out by reason of the arm of the mighty." And they've got all these people complaining because they're being oppressed and all this. But look at the next verse. "But none saith, where is God, my maker, who giveth songs in the night, who teacheth us more than the beast of the field, and maketh us wiser than the fowls of heaven?" I hear people complaining about they don't have this, they don't have that, but nobody's complaining because they don't have God. Where is the person who's hungry for God, who thirsts for God's presence? And then in chapter 34, in verse 5, Elihu says, "For Job hath said, I am righteous, and God hath taken away my judgment. I am not getting what I've got coming. God is not dealing with me fair. Job never directly accuses God of sin, but throughout his speech, he implies it. He insinuates it. It's like an old country and western song, somebody's done somebody wrong, and it ain't me. Well, if it ain't you, then who is it? Notice what Job is saying. It's like there's been a breakdown in the righteous system of heaven. I'm getting a done when I ought to have a credit. I'm being judged when I ought to be rewarded. Something's going wrong somewhere in between God and me. Something's out of kilter. I know I'm not wrong. I know I'm not a sinner. I don't deserve this, and yet it's happening. And if I could just find God, I'd straighten it out. Boy, I'd tell him a thing or two. I would order my arguments. I would give a speech that he would hear, and he'd say, "You know, Job, you're right. You've just been mistreated here." That's how Job ends his argument. And Elihu, as he gets close to the end of his, and I want you to see, starting in chapter 36, verse 27, Elihu starts making reference to the weather. In verse 27, he says, "He makes small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to their vapor." He alludes to a storm that is approaching. And here's the first allusion to it. And then notice in verse 30, "He spreadeth his light upon it and covereth the bottom of the sea." Oh, that's the wrong verse. Verse 32, "With clouds he covers the light and commands it not to shine by the cloud." It's like the thunderstorm is getting closer and closer. So he's looking at the raindrops off in the distance. But now the storm is getting closer and closer. And now in chapter 37, it's right overhead. Verse 2, "Hear attentively the noise of his voice, the sound that goeth out of his mouth. He directeth it under the whole heaven, and his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it a voice roareth, he thunders with the voice of his excellency." Do you get the idea that the storm is now overhead, the lightning and the thunder? Now the reason that's important is because no sooner does Elihu end in verse 24 of chapter 37 that God then speaks in chapter 38 verse 1, speaks out of the storm. So it's as if while Elihu is giving his counsel, his speech, his sermon to Job, the storm is getting closer and closer and closer. You see the rain coming, then finally the lightning and the thunder, and then God speaks. Now that's what Job wanted. He wanted to hear from God. Couldn't find God. Well, God shows up. And things not going to work out quite like Job thought they would. There is a reason why I think Elihu is right on target, and it's because much of what Elihu has charged God with in his speech, God now charges Job with the exact same things. And if we could read the Hebrew, we'd see it's almost in exactly the same words. That's the greatest kind of preaching, is when God comes along after you and pounds home the nail you've set. When he comes and thunders what you have been trying to get across. And that's why I'm thinking that Elihu is right on target, because God repeats many of the same things. Notice in chapter 38, verse 2, the first thing God says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" You can go back to chapter 34 and find Elihu says almost exactly that same thing, words without knowledge. The same thing he accuses Job of, now God accuses Job of. In chapter 40, in verse 2, God speaks and says, "Shall he that contends," to contend is to fight with the Almighty, "instruct him? He that reproves God, let him answer it." You can go back to chapter 33 and verse 13 and find that Elihu has said exactly those same words to Job. And so God is simply echoing what his servant has already proclaimed. And that's good preaching. He interrogates Job. Let's go back to chapter 38 a minute, and you'll see that in verse 3, he says to gird up your loins like a man, because I'm going to demand of you, and you answer me. Job, we're going to give you a little quiz. Because see, Job, you seem to think you're qualified to teach God. Well, you're going to have to get your teacher's certificate. You're going to have to pass your exam. Let's just see what you know. You want to put God on the stand and cross-examine Him? Well, Job, you're going to have to pass the bar. Isn't that right? We've got to find out if you're qualified to question God. And so God gives him a little quiz. Some little easy questions. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Verse 5, who hath laid the measure of it? Who hath stretched the line upon it? Let's see you step it off, Job. How big is it? Whereupon, in verse 6, whereupon are its foundations? How's it hanging out here? What's going on? And notice question after question. And notice that this is all about the natural realm. That's Job's domain. That's our specialty. It's sort of like an expert witness that you put on the stand. They're not expert in every field, but they're expert in the field they're testifying about. So Job, let's find out if you know anything about the one thing you ought to know a lot about. The natural realm, the natural world. And can you already hear Job sort of saying, well, don't know the answer to that one. Don't know the answer. He asks him all kinds of questions, and the common link is they're all about the natural world. And at the end of it, Job has nothing to say. In fact, Job had said, boy, if I could just ever get my day in court, I'd plead my case, I'd order my arguments. Look what happens in chapter 40, verse 3. Then Job answered the Lord when he does speak. He says, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further. I put my hand over my big fat mouth, lest I open it again. I was out of my league, out of my element. And so I quit. I'm through. Well, that may be fine, but God's not through with you. Because now he begins a second round of questioning. This one is not over what Job knows, but what can Job do? Verse 9, have you an arm like God? Roll them up, Job. You've been working out, doing a little P90X, you know. Let's see what you got. Let's roll up your sleeve. Let's compare. Deck yourself now with majesty and excellency. Array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold everyone that is proud and abase him. Job, let's go out on the town tonight and do a little king abasing. Let's pluck a man off the throne, put his nose in the dirt. Let's see you do that, Job. I heard a preacher one time say, God never ever humbles anybody. Now, I think I know his point is that we have the responsibility to humble ourselves. That's certainly true. But to say God never humbles anybody, you must have never read about Nebuchadnezzar that God put out to pasture. And Nebuchadnezzar, at the end of those seven times passing over him, says, well, this is the God of heaven. We're just like grasshoppers. And he that walks in pride, that God is able to abase. And so this is something God can do. Job, let's see you do that. Well, on and on. And verse 14, if you can do that, then I will also confess unto thee that thine own right hand can save you. You don't need me. You can handle yourself if you can do this. But if you can't, then you need me. You can't save yourself. He ends with pointing him in verse 15 to Behemoth. And then in chapter 41, verse 1, Leviathan. The jury is out on what those critters actually are. Some guess a hippo and a crocodile. Others guess some form of dragon or even prehistoric dinosaur. All I know is that these were creatures with which Job was familiar. So the hippo and the crocodile probably are the closest thing, although there are certain things here that don't seem to fit, but that's my best guess. And what God is saying, let's see you go one-on-one. Let's forget a king for a moment. Let's just see you go one-on-one with these creatures, with a hippo. Let's see you tame it. Let's see you ride him. Let's see you catch that crocodile with a hook, reel him in. Let's see you go one-on-one. And the point is, Job, you can't even handle other creatures. How dare you question your God? And so we come to the end of the story. The resolution is in chapter 42, and Job now speaks again. Chapter 42, verse 1, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, that no thought can be withheld from thee. Who is he who hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore I uttered that which I understood not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. Here I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Do you realize that Job knows no more about the reason for his suffering at the end of the book than he knew at the beginning? But he knows a whole lot more about God. The impropriety of questioning God. One of the first prayers I was ever taught as a child was when I went to bed at night to say, or sat down at the table rather, to say, "God is great, God is good, let us thank him for this food." Do you realize the tremendous theology comprised in that? That God is too wise to make a mistake, he's too good to do evil, he is God. It's like Tarzan and Jane, me Tarzan, you Jane, he God, you creature. He's the maker. You're the thing made. He's not here for you. You're here for him. And part of conversion is to have a gigantic shift in your worldview, in your paradigm of how things work. As sinful man lives his life, he lives in what I call a Ptolemaic worldview. Ptolemy, you know, was the ancient astronomer that said the earth is sitting still and everything is revolving around. That's what it looks like. We sit here. Do you feel like we're moving 1,000 miles an hour, spinning around? Doesn't feel like it. Seems like we're sitting still, doesn't it? And we look up and we see the moon and the sun, the stars moving. It seems like everything is just revolving around us. Lost man thinks everything is revolving around him. The cows are there for me to eat. Pigs there for me to have bacon. Chickens there for me to have eggs. And God's out there to give me salvation and forgiveness. After all, what else is God for? It's all about me. But conversion is, well, you know, it's interesting in Acts, they that have turn the world upside down, have come here also, they said in, what was that, Berea, Thessalonica? He didn't turn the world upside down, he's just turned it right side up. We need to have a Copernican worldview. Copernicus came along and says, no, all things are not revolving around us. We're revolving around the sun. Now, he didn't have it completely right, you understand, a lot more to it. But at least he had things worked out that, no, it's not that everything revolves around us. And that's how the sinner thinks. Our conversion is, no, I'm here to glorify my God, my Maker. And what he does is right and just. I can trust him. Notice he repents of his sin. Back earlier last evening, he's introduced as a perfect man, but I tried to make the case not sinlessly perfect. And here you see a sinlessly perfect man repenting. No, where'd the sin come from? The sin was there all along. The trial has just manifested it. You take a bar of gold and it looks pure, and you put it in a fire and you melt it down, and suddenly the dross comes to the top. And you want to say, look what that fire did to that gold. That fire put those impurities in that gold. No, it didn't. Those impurities were always there. The fire just manifested it. And so the trial has worked for Job's good in that it has brought this sin to light that was always there under the surface. And then notice that Job is required to make intercession for his friends. Look at what God says in Job 42, verse 7. It was after that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath." Now, this is confusing, because Job is just repenting of what he said, of speaking of things that were too high. He says in verse 3, "I uttered that which I understood not, things too wonderful me which I knew not." And yet God says he spoke right. How do we understand that? Some have taken it that it speaks of his words of repentance that he just uttered, that's what he has now spoken right. I take a different view, that basically it's the big picture. The three friends have contended from the beginning that Job is being punished for some great crime he's committed. Job has contended all along it's not that. And in that contest, Job is correct, and the three friends are wrong. And now Job is required to offer sacrifices for his three friends for no good reason. They don't. You could sort of see old Job over there. Well, guess who's right and who's wrong? And now guess who's going to get the judgment? But instead, Job is required to offer sacrifice on behalf of his friends. And we see in verse 10 that the Lord turns the captivity of Job when he prays for his friends. Job is now being required to live by the same principle with what God has dealt with him. And we're going to look at that tomorrow night, how that applies to us. But just a preview of coming attractions. And then notice the end. This is the part we like, that Job winds up with twice what he had in the beginning. He had 7,000 sheep, now he's got 14,000 sheep. He had 3,000 camels, for whatever reason I can't quite figure out, but now he has 6,000 camels. I can't imagine. He had 500 oxen, 500 donkeys, now he's got 1,000 of each. And so you might say, well, wait a minute, maybe there is something to this quid pro quo. After all, Job is being rewarded. And will not we be rewarded? Does that not imply that God's kingdom also works on the principle of quid pro quo? Something for something. We've served him, so we're going to get our paycheck. May I give you three reasons why that's just not true? First reason, and this is what Jesus said over in Luke 17. He told a story about servants going out in the field working all day and then coming in. Instead of sitting down, the master serving them, they served the master. And he says, "Therefore, when you have done everything, when you've done all your duty, say we are unprofitable servants. We've done that which was our duty to do." You see, at the end of the day, you say, "I'm going to do a little extra today." Well, what is our duty? According to Christ, it is we love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We love our neighbor as ourselves. How are you going to go beyond that? And you say, well, if I've done that, then I've done something that ought to be rewarded. And this is saying, no, wait a minute. That's your duty. That's what you're here for. To serve and honor and glorify your God. And when you've done it, it's just your duty. It's nothing extra. There are no works of supererogation, as the Catholic Church teaches, you know, over and above what we're demanded to do. When you've done everything you can do, that's just your duty. That's why your works will never pay for your sins. If you could stop sinning today and start doing good works from now on, your good works are never going to cover those sins because it's your duty. It's like saying to the highway patrol when he pulls you over for doing 80 out there on the freeway, "But officer, I drove the speed limit last week." Or you're brought to a judge condemned of murdering somebody and you say to the judge, "But just think of all the people that didn't murder." Big whoopee. That's your duty. You don't get brownie points for that. And the same thing is true here. God owes us nothing. If we give him our all, that's our duty. That's the first reason. Second reason is what Paul reminds us of over in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, "By the grace of God, I am what I am." The fact that he's a Christian at all, the fact that he's an apostle. This is all due to the grace of God. If that wasn't clear in anybody else's life, it ought to be clear in Paul's life. But then he goes on to say, but this grace that was given to me was not given in vain. I labored more than all the rest of them. He said, oh, Paul, pat yourself on the back. And he says, yet not I, but the grace of God that was with me. That the zeal and the energy and the efforts that I expended was still the grace of God. This is God working in me and through me. In other words, this is not quid pro quo, something for something. This is grace for grace. And then thirdly, when God rewards His people, and we will be rewarded. And I think that's one of the reasons this is found here in the end of the book of Job. It reminds us that no one's ever going to be the loser for serving God, for trusting Him, for venturing upon Him. You can trust Him safely, and He will not let you ultimately be the loser. But I want you to realize this is not direct payment, quid pro quo. It is gifts, rewards, all out of proportion to what we've done. Jesus told a parable of the pounds, you know. The guy's going away. He gives 10 pounds. That's an amount of money in the hands of 10 servants. Comes back. One of them made 10 more pounds with that pound. What did he say? You've been faithful with this. Be thou ruler over 10 cities. Think about that. The money wasn't even his. He's a servant. He's a slave of his master. It's his master's money. That's what he's supposed to be doing with it, making money for his master. That's his duty. That's his job. He didn't cough it up. He didn't invest it. It was placed in his hands. That's the way we work. Everything we've got, your natural gifts, your intelligence, your resources, it's all been a gift to you. And notice when he's faithful, the master rewards him all out of proportion. Be a ruler over 10 cities because you were faithful with 10 pounds. And so it is with us, my friend, in glory, rewarded all out of proportion to any faithfulness or service. But rewarded, yes, rewarded as co-heirs, joint heirs with Christ. Even if you're in it for the profit motive, this is the best reason I can give you for being a Christian. To be joined to Christ means that, yes, you suffer with Him, but you shall also reign with Him. You shall be glorified with Him and share in His glory, in His rule, in His reign. You say, what am I getting? That's what Job's saying. What am I getting? Remember the elder brother? You never did anything for me, and this old boy comes home and you're doing this for him. What did I ever get? And what did the father say? The whole farm is yours. It's all yours. You got to live with me. And so it is with the Christian. I have no clue what heaven's going to be like. I think I have a notion. You know I have an opinion. I wouldn't have brought that up. I love astronomy. As a little kid, I fell in love with the universe, and my, this universe is something. As far as we can tell, about 13, 14 billion light years. I mean, light travels 186,000 miles a second. Let me put it this way. The distances in the solar system alone from here to the sun are such that light traveling that fast, if the sun went out, it'd be 8 minutes before you knew it. Takes light 8 minutes to get from the sun to your eye. You say, well, I see the sun. You don't. Because by the time you see the sun, sun's not there anymore. It's already moved on. You're seeing where the sun was 8 minutes ago. And that's the closest star. The next star is over 3 light years away. Not 8 minutes, traveling 186,000 miles a second. 3 years away. And we look across the galaxies, across this universe, as far as we can tell, about 14 billion light years across. And it's filled with roughly 100 billion galaxies like our Milky Way, each containing about 100 billion stars like our sun. Let that sink in. 100 billion galaxies containing an average of 100 billion stars. Folks, this thing's big. And you say, well, God did that so he could just astound us with his might and his glory. Yeah, he could have done a lot smaller and still astounded us with his glory. I mean, this is mind-boggling big. And you say, well, what? What do you think that's for? Why did he make it so big? I don't know, but I've always had a hunch that just maybe, that is the inheritance of his saints. One day I'm going to look up and say, boy, look at old Brother Mike's star. Doesn't that look good? We need to go up there and see what he's doing in that on that third planet out there. You say, Brother Mike, this is just all speculation. I know it is. I know it is. All I'm saying is eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard the things that God has prepared for them that love him. When the kings of this earth want to glorify their children, they do a pretty good job. They pull out all the stops, pull out all the jewelry, all the glory. But my friend, when the God of this universe glorifies his children, oh, what a day that will be. Don't miss the big show. It's found in Jesus Christ and nowhere else. And notice, Job had twice everything else. He wound up with seven sons and three daughters, same number he had. Now, some say that was his wife's punishment. Ten more kids to bear. But why did he just get the same number of children? Well, one suggestion is that he never really lost the first ones. But they'll be waiting for him up there. Thank you. This has been tough, I know, to try to get so much. It's like trying to drink out of a fire hose. But I wanted to acquaint you, and I want you to see this idea of legalism, how it just is woven through the warp and woof of this book, and it's what you've got to contend with and deal with. And tomorrow evening, I want to bring this series to a close in saying, what does it mean to me and you? We've seen the situation with Job. How do we apply it to us? Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the experience of a man like Job and what we can learn from it. Lord, we would not condemn him. We know that we're not a tenth the man he was. And we know, Father, for all his faults and failures, ours would have been far, far worse. But Lord, we see that at the end of the day that the best of us are debtors to your mercy and grace. The best of us doing our best can never get ahead. We can never get you over the barrel where you owe us. That we are debtors to your grace and mercy alone, and you are a gracious and a good God who loves to shower his children with good things. And Father, if we are required now to suffer in this life without cause, for no good reason, simply because it is the will of our God to bring glory to our God, then may we be willing to do it. Father, we pray that you would bless us as we mull over these things and let the truth of them sink deeply within our ears, that our lives might be transformed and changed by what we hear in these days. In the name of Jesus, I ask it. Amen.